Thank you, Baz, for that magnificent introduction. Over the top, I thought, but very nice, nevertheless. Can everybody hear me all right? Is this a good microphone position? Okay. Up higher. Is that better? Right. Louder.
Louder, louder, louder. I'm not
sure. I think we're on top volume. Okay. Oh, that's better. Got closer. Right. So my talk today, which I'll go for about 40 minutes, is on the Russian national character, the motherland, Rodina, and national cultural identity. Now that's a very formidable title. I originally started with something a little bit more informal called A Riff on Russianness. Riff being a sort of a theme repeated in music with variations. And my native Russian-speaking friend Marina Ishkakova said to me, we can't really put riff into Russian. It's not a Russian word. So we came up with a title, Rasmyshlenia o Ruskom Narodnom Dushe, Reflections on the Spirit of the Russian People. And that's sort of what this is in a way. And what I'm going to be going through is those themes on the board there, which you can look at as I introduce this talk, and I won't have to read through them because I hope you can all read them. I want to say, talk about in what ways Russia is different from the West. And I don't use this in any pejorative way. I actually admire and I honour these differences. I don't regard them as shortcomings. I want to spell this out. As many Western writers on Russia do say, for example, Russia missed the Reformation or Russia missed the Enlightenment. Well, I mean, to me that's profoundly unscientific because every country has its own history and its own experience. You might as well say the West missed the Russian Revolution. The West missed 70 years of communism. So, I mean, it's a meaningless statement, really. So I'd like to honour the differences and hopefully we'll all know a little bit more about the differences at the end of this 40 minutes. It draws on my personal lifetime experience and observation of Russia. I first went there, as Baz says, in 69 at the age of 25 as a very junior third secretary on my first posting in a very small embassy. And I tell the story of that posting in the first part of my book, Return to Moscow, which is on sale over there with the charming young ladies, Ariadna and Veronica, who are learning lots of arithmetic because I have no credit card facilities and they have a very large sum of money which they're in charge of. So if any of you have $50 notes or $20 notes or even $100 notes, they will be able to give you change. My book is $30 and I hope after you've read this talk you'll be stimulated to want to read more. I think a lot of Russians here today will think about much of what I have to say. Well, look, that's obvious. I knew that already. And please bear with me. For the non-Russian members of the audience, there might be some surprises here. And this is all about enhancing understanding, really. Century 19 and early 20th century Russia was a very young country, like Australia. But it was also a very old country. Let me explain that. Russia had been through its first, well, actually its second major cultural revolution under Peter the Great, who decided to move the embassy from Moscow to St. Petersburg, break a window through to the West, and literally transform the manners and morals of the country in a most, you know, cultural revolution had nothing on what Peter the Great did. It was amazing. He made it, the nobles all shave their beards, wear Western dress. He made them speak another language. He made them learn French and actually speak French at home and think in French. It was all about making Russia a great power, a great European power. And Peter's motto was, well, if you can't, the only way to beat them is to join them. And this was his, as I say, huge cultural revolution. And then in the 19th century, after the Napoleonic Wars, the Russians rediscovered their country. The Russian elite, that is. The peasants never lost their country, but the elite certainly almost did. And they rediscovered their country, and through the 19th century, they were rediscovering their Russian identity. Just as Australia was developing its identity from a rather provincial and dull and, in many ways, ignorant offshoot of the British Empire, we started to ask ourselves the question, well, what are we? What is it to be Australian? And at the same time, Russians were asking themselves, the Russian elite, what is it to be Russian? What does it mean? And so we have this wonderful flowering of creativity with Pushkin and Turgenev and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and on the painting side, Repin and Levitan and so on. All, I forgot Lermontov, how could I forget Lermontov? All expressing Russian identity. And in music, we've got Borodin and Mussorgsky and Tchaikovsky and Rimsky-Korsakov. And this is incredibly creative and a wonderful time. There were important differences. Sorry, I wanted to say another thing, an important point. We both suffered from the tyranny of huge distances. We both suffered from very different but very harsh climatic challenges. We had histories of convict transportation. Both of us were sending convicts away or accepting convicts at the same time, roughly. The Russians sent them to Kamchatka and Sakhalin and right through Siberia, really. And we sent them to New South Wales. And we also suffered from the disdain of metropolitan Europe. Both Russia and Australia were always not quite European, always trying to make it and not quite making it. So we had a lot in common. We were both outsiders. But there were differences. Russia had no natural frontiers. We, of course, are an island with the most superb natural frontiers, an island continent, an island nation. And in Russia, they were up against different civilizations, some very high, some not so high, on their borders, in all directions, north, south, east, and west. And they had to learn to live with those civilizations. And they were invaded and occupied by those civilizations. For much of its history, early history, Russia was basically subjugated by the Mongols, by the Tatars. And that had an enormous impact on the development of Russian culture and values. Eventually, the tide turned, and Russia started expanding, and this was around the time of Ivan the Terrible, around the 16th century. And Russia started steadily expanding to the east, and then that meant coping with all these new challenges. How do we absorb these people? How do we absorb the Cossacks, the Tatars, the Kulyaks, the Chechens, the Dagestanis? How do we do this? And so Russia was learning to live with multiculturalism for a long, long time. And today, Russia is a Christian country, basically, still. And today is the Russian Orthodox Easter Sunday. I'm sorry that there couldn't have been more Russians here today, but many of them are sleeping off their midnight mass. And so I will happy to say, Christos Voskres. And some of you will know what to say in reply. That's right. He's truly risen. Christ is risen. He is truly risen. I won't talk about Manning's and my lives in Moscow except to say that they were very different, because I want to get onto the meat of this. But I did have a very artificial life in Moscow, which is talked about in my memoir book over there. As a young Western diplomat, I was behind a glass window and couldn't really engage because of security reasons on both sides. But Manning, of course, engaged, and Dimfner engaged, and they had wonderful hospitality from their Russian hosts through the Australian-Soviet Friendship Society, which I wasn't allowed to have anything to do with, of course. But so we were experiencing Russia in different ways, but we both, at the end, really loved Russia. Now, I'm going to start the substance of my talk with the Russian landscape, and let's go to the first slide, please, Adam. There we go, a road in the Rye. There's a typical bit of steppe land. And most of Russia is made up of immensely broad climatic and vegetation bands that run from east to west. And going from north to south, you've got the tundra, the Arctic tundra, then you've got the Arctic forest, which is pretty spindly boreal forest. Then you've got the real deciduous forest. Then you have the steppe, and this is steppe. And then you have dry desert country in the far south. So it's like a layer cake with these broad bands. And most of Russian history took place in the deciduous forest zone where most of the Slavs lived, And because they had shelter there and animals to hunt and they could, you know, grow food, they had the river systems and so on, it was very fertile and hospitable land. And most of the nomad invaders kept moving forwards and backwards across the steppe lands because the nomad people were horse people. They moved at the speed of a horse. They carried all their belongings with them on carts, and they were wild people, and they're part of Russia's heritage. And Alexander Blok wrote a famous poem called The Scythians around the time of the revolution when everything was in turmoil. And he was telling the Europeans, beware of us. We're not what you think we are. We are not Europeans. We are Scythians. And there's a saying, scratch a Russian and find a Tatar, which is in some ways a derogatory saying, but actually it's something that Russians can be very proud of, I think, because it says part of Russia's heritage is this magnificent nomadic Tatar heritage. So you've got these waves of people, the Scythians, the Polovtsians, the Huns, the Mongols, out of the east, very often commingling, and helping to shape a civilization. A multicultural identity comes out of all this. I maintain it's united by three things: imperial power, the power of the empire, the Russian language, which was the lingua franca, lingua slavonica, and the values of the Russian Orthodox Church, which kind of, even though there were many religions, not everybody was Orthodox, inevitably the Orthodox values, which were part of the state's values, became part of the texture of the Russian value system. We'll go to slide 3, and that is a horse from the Tersk stud in the Northern Caucasus. Beautiful horse. It's a Russian Arab. The Russian Arabs have beautiful bloodlines, to anybody who knows anything about horses. And I'm going to talk a little bit about a wonderful modern Russian song called Kon, which has become a folk song, although it was composed and first performed in 1994 in the depths of the time of troubles, when really Russians wondered whether there's any future in their country anymore. They just experienced the second major revolution of modern times, the abandonment of the Soviet system that left human relationships that had grown out of that system in tatters, the society in tatters and in misery, and it was a terrible, terrible time, the time of troubles. And in these hard times, this song, Kon, struck an amazing chord, and I'm going to spend a bit of time on it because its lyrics are really very important. It became an unofficial national anthem of Russia, and it speaks to the people's deepest feelings of love for the country. Kon is sung by all sorts of choirs. It was in fact sung by the Slavonic choir here a few months ago, at one of our early Pushkin House events. What are the key ideas in Kon? And we'll go to the next slide now. The key ideas in Kon are really about the Russian rider and their horse riding out on the steppe, the beauty and the peace of the steppe, comforting lights in faraway villages, the breaking dawn, the ripening rye and flax, and the berry crops, and the good harvest to come. And I suppose it's a song not only of loving Russia, it's a song of being in love with Russia. Я влюблён в тебя, Россия, влюблён. I have fallen in love with you, Russia. I've fallen in love. And that's a very strong statement. I'll read out to you a few stanzas and then we'll hear it as sung on the radio. I will go into the fields at night with my horse. Quietly we'll go out into the starry night. Together my horse and I will go out into the fields. The grace of the stars fills the fields. In the fields no one can be seen. My horse and I are going out into the fields. I will sit in the saddle of my horse. You will carry me across the fields. Over the endless fields you will carry me. Let me see just once where the fields give birth to the dawn. My dear fields, dear springs, the lights of faraway villages. Golden rye, yes, and curly flax. I'm in love with you, Russia, in love. The light it will be a good harvest this year, so it always has been and always will be. Sing golden rise, sing curly flax, sing of how I'm in love with you, Russia. Now, as you hear the song and see this little scratch choir singing it somewhere in a major city in Russia, try to feel the emotion. You won't understand the words, most of you, but try to feel how the emotion builds. Can we have the song, please? Okay, can we go to the next slide, please? Yes. So there's one of the famous horses. That's Peter the Great mounted on his horse in St. Petersburg. It's a very ambivalent statue. It sends a lot of ambivalent messages. And Pushkin's poem, Yedny Vsadnik, the Bronze Horseman, is based on that statue. And the next slide, please. Marshal Georgi Zhukov, the hero of World War II, trampling on his horse, Kumir, over the Nazi banners. And that's the sort of the famous statue, which I'll come back to at the end. Next slide, please. We have Pushkin now. Now, Pushkin talked about going out in the fields, and his famous poems, Autumn and Winter Morning, express the his love for basically what that song, Kon, is about, getting on your horse and riding out on the steppe. He loved the steppe both in summer and winter, and he really enjoyed being at a place called Boldino, his family estate, which is way out in the boonies. I always thought it was somewhere in the northern western Russia, but in fact it's not. It's right out on the frontiers, south of Nizhny Novgorod, getting down towards Kazakhstan almost. It was very much in the Tatar borderlands. And when he was exiled by the Tsar, which was quite often, he would retreat to Boldino, and there his essential Russianness came through most happily and most strongly. He just loved being down there on his family estate at Boldino. And the Boldinsky Dni, the Bolden days, are very important days in his creativity. Also, his story, Snowstorm and the Captain's Daughter, feature the Russian landscape in winter. And very often, you literally go off the road. You just get lost because the roads disappeared completely in the blizzards. And Snowstorm and the Captain Metiel and Kapitanskaya Dochka, Snowstorm and the Captain's Daughter, the stories hang on the loss of bearings. And you can so easily lose bearings on the steppe. And the next slide shows... We'll go to the next slide, please. The next slide. I think we've... No. Can we go to the next slide? That's it. Winter landscape in Suzdal, which is near Moscow. Graham Bates and I visited there, and that actually could be anywhere in Russia. You've got the frozen river in front. You've got the village behind. You've got the church. And that is such a typical Russian or Siberian landscape. These landscapes, they're very similar for 3,000 kilometers or more, 8,000 kilometers, right across eight time zones. It's still Russia. It's an amazing continuity. I just showed you briefly Dr. Zhivago's house, and we might go to that again. Dr. Zhivago, there it is. Now, that was used in the film, but it's so evocative. This is where Zhivago and Lara met for their last tryst before they had to separate, before she went with her daughter Tanya and her unborn daughter Katya by him. Katya was Zhivago's daughter. Tanya was her daughter, her husband, Sasha Antipov. She went into exile with a scoundrel called Komarovsky, who's the sort of person who... individual who comes to the top in any revolution. Komarovsky promised to protect Lara and the children. He didn't, but that's another story. And the film, which is heartbreakingly beautiful, and I think if you ask me where my love of Russia begins, it probably begins with Julie, who, let's go to the next slide. Julie Christie, although she's English, she expresses that sort of ethereal Russian beauty that sort of sweeps every man away, I think. And of course, Omar Sharif wasn't too bad either for the ladies. But their story is just wonderful. And I'm going to read a poem by Pasternak, which is at the end of Dr. Zhivago, which is one of the world's greatest novels. You must read Zhivago, it can be nothing else. There's a set of poems, and they're all loosely connected to the themes of the book. And this is the one of Lara, basically, when she comes out to Varikina to meet Yuri Zhivago up there. When snow covers the roads and lies heavily on the roofs. Oh, it's Zhivago speaking, by the way. When snow covers the roads and lies heavily on the roofs, I'll go out to stretch my legs and I'll see you standing at the door, alone in an autumn coat, hatless without snow boots, chewing a handful of snow and trying to be calm. The trees and the fences vanish into the dark distance. Alone in the snowfall, you stand at the corner. Water drips from your kerchief, trickles down your sleeves, and sparkles like dew in your hair. I talked about how Napoleon's invasion forced Russia back into rediscovering and celebrating its own self. Pushkin understood this very well. He was profoundly ambivalent about Tsarist power. At the same time, he was profoundly patriotic. So he was a man of great contradictions, as his epic poem, The Bronze Horseman, shows. As for Tolstoy, his sense of Russianness was central to both his great novels, War and Peace and Anna Karenina. And there's a wonderful moment in War and Peace. The pivotal scene of Natasha's dance perhaps best symbolizes this. And there's Natasha's dance, as visualized by somebody. She's gone visiting with her family to a middle-aged relative who lives near their country estate in a rather more modest estate. He's given up on the ruthless social whirl of St. Petersburg. He's retreated to live quietly as a bachelor with his mistress, who's a peasant background. She, a warm-hearted woman, teaches Natasha to dance Russian folk. And Natasha, who's never danced anything but French-style ballroom dancing, finds that the balalaika music and the Russian steps come naturally to her. It's a joyous discovery of her true identity, Natasha's dance. And this was happening through every field of culture in the years following the Napoleonic Wars. And you can see this most strongly in the Tretyakov galleries, which are wonderful galleries in Moscow of historically based art. And I can't recommend them too highly who's visiting Moscow. In my book, Return to Moscow, I talk about why I prefer the word Russophilia to Slavophilia. Because, you see, there was this huge argument going on through the 18th and 19th century between the Westernizers, the Zapadniks, and the Slavophiles. But I maintain that it should really be called Russophiles, because what we're counterpointing to the Westernizing tendency is the tendency to celebrate all of Slav culture, or sorry, all of Russian culture, which finished up being much bigger than Slav culture. As I say, it became a Russian world, a Ruski Mir, which encompassed all these wonderful different elements. Slavs, Jews, Russian-speaking Balts, Volga Germans, Cossacks, Tatars, indigenous Siberians, Bielorussians, even Ukrainians. They were all part of this Ruski Mir, this big sort of commonwealth of cultural connection, really. The next slide, please. This is a famous painting of a group of Cossacks who are writing a letter to the Turkish Sultan, rejecting his demand that they swear fealty to him. And they're obviously having a great deal of fun writing this letter. And it sort of shows a lot about what life was like on the borderlands, on the frontiers. It was anarchical, it was wild, it was often brutal, but it was also free. You didn't have serfdom on the borderlands. So it's the wild frontier of Russia. Next slide, please. I'm going to talk a little bit now about class. I've talked about multiculturalism, the Russian world, I'm going to touch now on class. Because originally Russia had just two classes, the aristocracy, the nobility, if you like, and the serfs. And one class basically provided the military muscle and the governments and the power, and the other side, other class, provided the labor. And then you had a few sort of hangers-on, people who did the accounts and the banking and the small merchant classes, but there were basically just two classes, elite and peasants. And the intelligentsia initially came out of the elite, but gradually, as education spread, you started getting peasant class or working class intellectuals starting to well. So in War and Peace, it's mostly engaging characters who are from the aristocracy, from the nobility, but there's one character called Platon the philosopher, who teaches Pierre Bezukhov, who's the hero of War and Peace, important lessons about acceptance of what fate has to offer, really. He doesn't teach Pierre docility, he teaches him stoicism. And it's this quality of stoicism in the Russian working class and peasantry, which is very often mistaken by Western observers for passivity or docility. It's not. It's not at all. It's a bit like the Irish proverb, God give me the wisdom to change the things I can, to accept the things I can't change, and to know the difference between them. I'm sure you've all heard that proverb in one form or another. That is the spirit, I think, of stoicism and philosophical resignation to what is inevitable that characterizes Russian culture. Now, Tolstoy was succeeded by another very important figure, Chekhov. And Chekhov is absolutely wonderful, and I'll go 100 miles to hear any Chekhov play. We had a wonderful one recently at the Electric Shadows, a filmed version of Uncle Vanya from London, which was absolutely brilliant. And Chekhov, they're always doctors in his plays, and they always have this capacity to look at society at the broad and to move easily between the classes. So in Uncle Vanya, for example, Dr. Astarov, he moves around all the time, treating people in their villages, in their houses, trying to save their lives with the rudimentary medicine of the day. And he keeps saying, in 100 years' time, it'll all be so much better than it is now. People will look back on us and say how primitive we are. Well, quite honestly, I look back now at Russia around the turn of the century, around 1900, and I think in many ways it's more civilized than we are. But that could be a subject for another day. Moving on from Chekhov, we come to Pasternak. And once again, Dr. Zhivago is a key novel. And I've already said, I think it's the most important novel to read about Russia. I've already said a little bit about that, and I won't repeat it. And I'll move on to the next very important writer, who is Vasily Grossman. Now, he's a character who many of you will not have heard of, I don't think. He was a secular Jewish intellectual who grew up in Berdichev, a largely Jewish town in central Ukraine, getting up towards the border with Bielorussia. He became a member of the new Soviet literary intelligentsia, and in the Great Patriotic War, he became a leading Soviet war correspondent. His mother, who refused to evacuate her hometown, she was a member of the intelligentsia in Berdichev. She said, nobody's going to bother me, I'm just an old woman. She stayed there, and she was killed by the Nazis when they occupied. And Grossman carried this personal heartbreak all his life. Why didn't I force my mother to evacuate when she had the chance? In his wonderful novel Stalingrad, we see through the eyes of its huge cast of characters how complex ethnic and class identities were now interacting in a respectful and even loving way. And the Soviet system, which had given free education to all, except tragically the families of the former elite, who were excluded from that, had indeed created a new, more fluid and more varied intelligentsia class with many different elements. So we encounter in Stalingrad people whom we haven't encountered in classical Russian literature or even in Zhivago. We encounter industrial managers, scientists, professional military officers, doctors, party political workers, and surviving members of the old artistic and creative intelligentsia. So it's a rich tapestry of characters, and we see these people behaving heroically at the war and surviving complicated private lives at the same time. It's a more egalitarian world, but it's still a world of high intellectual and moral standards, and it's united by a strong sense of Russianness and a love for the motherland. Obviously, Grossman, who's justly been called the Tolstoy of the Soviet era, was idealizing these fictional characters, but they're nonetheless very real. Quite a few of them are of a secular Jewish background, as Grossman himself was. He wrote under censorship, and the Stalinist excesses were already wreaking havoc in his Soviet world, before, during, and even after the Patriotic War of 1941-45. Grossman elliptically touches on this in his novels, finally and most clearly in his last novel, Everything Flows, which actually talks about the attack on the kulaks. It's a very, very sad and powerful novel. I see very strong qualities of Russianness uniting all of these writers, Pushkin, Turgenev, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Pasternak, and Grossman. What's so special about these characters is that they, for the most part, are decent, compassionate, even admirable people of great seriousness of purpose and high ideals. They have a different view of the individual's responsibilities to society than do characters in most classic Western novels. You don't see people in Jane Austen or Charles Dickens having conversations about society the way you do in Russian novels. That's the difference. Russian novels are immensely serious, and even when Lara and Yuri are, you know, clutched in their embraces, they're still thinking about Russia, they're still thinking about their obligations to society, and that's what makes Zhivago a very Russian novel. People are trying to find the right balance between personal happiness and their obligations to serve their societies. So once again, there's a lot of misunderstanding of this in the West. There's a sense that, well, Russians are really collectivist. Well, they're not really collectivist. They're collectivist in the sense that Catholics in Western Europe were collectivist before the Reformation. There is this sense that we are not just individuals, we're also members of a society. And we actually have an obligation to look out for one another. Funnily enough, under the influence of COVID, we're rediscovering that now in Australia. We are discovering that, you know, you don't just leave people to die in their apartments and not discover them until their bodies start to smell. You know, we are actually discovering that we have to ask each other, how are you going? We have to look out for each other. And that is something that Russian people have known for a very long time, always really. You know, we can make jokes about the inquisitive little old ladies who sit on the steps of Russian housing complexes, apartment complexes, and, you know, keep an eagle eye on everybody coming and going. And we can regard that as an intrusion on personal freedom, but it's actually a rather wonderful thing when you think about it, because those little old ladies are making every courtyard in a Moscow apartment block into a sort of a village. And they're the, you know, the eyes and ears of the village, and they know what's going on, and they just help maintain a sense of community. So when we come back to Stalingrad, and I'm to Stalingrad now, a lot of it's about the long controlled retreat of the Russian army and people across about 1,500, 2,000 kilometers of Ukraine, all the way from the Dnieper River in the west around Kiev, across past the Don, and finally to the Volga. In Stalingrad, the old Tsaritsyn city is on the Volga. And it's the last Russian city before you cross the Volga and basically get into Kazakhstan, the dry steppes of Kazakhstan. So in that long retreat, it's a very important point I want to make here. They fled their homes, and Grossman describes this all beautifully. They were sad to leave their homes, yes, but they couldn't conceive of living there under the Nazis. They were not going to stay there for that. And I'm not just talking about the Jews here. I'm talking about everyone. Huge numbers of people fled eastwards. Not fled, that's the wrong word. Retreated eastwards to a point where the state on which they relied to defend them would decide, it's now time to make our stand. wait until the Germans are overextended, wait until they're exhausted. We will hit back when the time is right. And isn't this exactly what the Russian general Kuznetsov did in the 1812? He let Napoleon occupy Moscow. Stalin didn't let Napoleon didn't let Hitler occupy Moscow, but no. In 1812, the Russian high command let Moscow be occupied because they knew what would happen to the French army sitting in Moscow for 3 months, and then that terrible winter retreat when finally Russia hit back. And in the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, Russia finally hit back in Stalingrad. And that battle went on for 6 months, and millions of people on both sides died. We cannot comprehend the scale of it. We simply cannot comprehend the scale of it. But this next monument, yes, this is the Stalingrad Monument, and there on the right, it's one of the largest statues in the world. And notice it's a woman. It's a woman, and I'll come back to that. Russia has been able to move its capitals very easily, as it's been able to move its population pretty easily. When I was talking about the people retreating right across Ukraine, the controlled retreat, they took with them their icons, and they took with them their family photographs. And that was all they really needed. Their houses could go, but if they had the icons and if they had the family photos, that was their identity, and they could reconstruct on the basis of that. So when we look at how the capitals moved around, well, goodness me, it started off in Kiev, and then when Kiev was occupied, it moved up to Novgorod, way up near the northern borders. And then Peter the Great moved it to St. Petersburg. And then when the Poles invaded Russia and actually occupied Moscow for a while, the sort of the Russian capital and the ruling class moved eastwards to Vladimir Suzdal and even further east to Nizhny Novgorod. And that's where the counterattack against the Poles came from. And then when Peter the Great moved the capital to St. Petersburg, his window into Europe. And then finally, in 1941, the last move of the capital, the Soviet state moved it 1,000 kilometers to the southeast to a town called Kubyshev, now back to its old name, Tsarist name, Samara, beautiful romantic name, Samara, on the Volga, about halfway along where the Volga curves around in a great big loop a long way to the east of the front line. And for 2 years, the capital was actually in Kubyshev. And the first Australian embassy, the first Australian ambassador to the Soviet Union, was posted to Kubyshev, not to Moscow. So it's still the Russian world wherever you are. You carry your suitcases of photos, you carry your icons, you might go all the way to Vladivostok, to Nakhodka. It's still Russia. It's China to the south, and it's a very different place, China, but all the way going east-west along the Trans-Siberian, people say it's all still the same. It's all still Russia. What an amazing country. Now, in Stalingrad, this terrible six-month battle, the tide of war turned. And after the war, Marshal Zhukov commented, he commanded Russian armies in the war. It's a very important statement. It is a fact, I won't try to reproduce it in a Russian accent, it is a fact that under equal conditions, large-scale battles and whole wars are won by troops which have a strong will for victory, clear goals before them, high moral standards, and devotion to the banner under which they go into battle. And I mean, I've never heard more beautifully expressed a statement of what are we fighting for. And that statement of Zhukov's applied not just to the troops and officers, but to everybody behind them, everybody who was supporting them, their loyal and loving families, the support people who, you know, kept bringing the supplies forward. They were literally turning out tanks every few minutes in Nizhny Novgorod and sending to the front line without bothering to paint them. they just finished them, and while they were still warm from the castings, they were riveting them together and sending them out. It was just amazing, that war effort. And I want to say now a few key words about Russianness. And here we are, Bogomatria Umilenia, This is the Mother of God of Tenderness, and it's a very famous, important icon theme. And this one I photographed in a wonderful icon museum in Novgorod, up near St. Petersburg. And you must try to go to Novgorod if you go to Russia and go to this icon museum. It's just a magnificent place. And that lovely icon says a lot to me about the Russian language, which I'll talk about for a moment now. I want to talk about a few words. There's no word in Russian for patriotism. There's just patriotism, which is just a transplant. If a Russian wants to talk about patriotism, he talks about Lyubov k Rodine, the love of the motherland. Patriotism is the love of the motherland, not the fatherland, the motherland. There are words certainly for fatherland. There's Otechestvo, there's Otchizna, but the most important word of all is Rodina, motherland. And Rodina comes from the root word rod, which is an everything word, really, which means genus, race, kind, family, generation, clan, kin, bloodline. And you see, rod, all of those things, comes through the mother, because Rodina is feminine. And a Russian mother nurtures her children, as in this wonderful icon of 1460, whereas a Russian father protects them against enemies. So we've got some pretty well-defined gender roles here, I'm sorry to say, for anybody who thinks that's inappropriate. Now, for Russians, World War II was called the Great Patriotic War. Velikaya Otechestvennaya Vayna, Great Patriotic War, because it was the defense of the fatherland, the defense of the motherland. Narod, people, comes from Nashrod, our people, our kind. So when you talk about Ruski Narod, you're talking about the Russian nation, but principally you're talking about the Russian people, Ruski Narod. And then finally, there's a family of words around Duk, which can mean spirit, mind, ghost, soul, wind, or esprit. And the feminine word Dusha means almost exactly the same things. I couldn't really tell the difference between Duk and Dusha. But both words have a very important religious or spiritual connotation, because the Holy Spirit, Svetoy Duk, the Holy Spirit. And the Russian word for breathing is Dukhanya, Dukhanya, Dukhanya. And remember all those sayings about the Holy Spirit breathes into people? That's all this word, Duk, comes right through everything. It's all connected. And I'll turn from there to religious faith, stoicism, and optimism. And there is the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow. Hram Krista Spasitelya. Hram Krista Spasitelya. Which has an incredible history. The first version of this cathedral was built after the Napoleonic Wars to celebrate the salvation of Russia. And it lasted through the 19th century until Stalin, in the 20th century, had it demolished as part of his war on religion. He hated it. He wanted it gone. And he was going to build a huge skyscraper there with a statue of Lenin on top. Now, fortunately, the archaeologists, the cultural historians, managed to retrieve all of the icons and all the paintings and all the wall hangings, and everything inside the cathedral, basically. Everything that could be moved was saved and catalogued. Stalin never got around to building a skyscraper. He dug a dirty big hole in the ground. Khrushchev built a swimming pool there, and I actually swam in that swimming pool. Awful place. Very gloomy. Carried a lot of overtones for me. And then in Yeltsin's time, Yeltsin is a controversial figure, but this is one really good thing he did. He ordered that the cathedral be rebuilt exactly as it was. And he ordered that in 1994, and it was completed in record time in 2000, just in time for the next president. And it's a wonderful cathedral. Graham Bates and I have been there. We love going there. Can we see the interior now, the next one? That's how it is. We love going there to Sunday Mass, the warm golden light from high above, the scent of incense, the magnificent choir. the chanting of the priest and the devout worshippers. It's an enthralling experience, it really is. And if you're ever in Moscow on a Sunday, don't miss it. Now, Russia today is a state that sees itself as having a moral and ethical duty in the world. And this grows out of the unbroken Christian narrative. And here it's really important that Russia didn't have a reformation, I think, because this Christian-based narrative has just continued right through everything. All of the changes of capital, all of the invasions, the tyranny of the Mongols for hundreds of years. And in 19th century Russia, the elite certainly flirted with agnosticism and atheism. And if you read about Prince Bolkonsky in War and Peace, he's an out-and-out atheist. And Tolstoy channels through Prince Bolkonsky this sort of fashionable atheism, I would call it, of the elite. But of course, the peasantry always remained intensely religious. And the Tsars were always generous in their financial support of not just the Russian Orthodox Church, but all the churches. They gave subventions out of the state treasuries to all the churches so they could appropriately maintain themselves. And even Stalin, he found during the Great Patriotic War that he had to work with the churches to keep that spirit of patriotism alive, to help Russia win that terrible war. And so the churches came out from underground during World War II, the Great Patriotic War. We're doing pretty well here. You're being very patient, but we're getting towards not quite the end, but the end is in sight. I would maintain that from that Russian religious background, which is much more important, I think, in Russian life than any religious background here, despite whatever our present prime minister may be doing, you find good values, good public values. And I can feel it the minute I arrive in Moscow when somebody helps me down an escalator in the metro station with a heavy suitcase and says, "Can I help you, sir?" and carries my suitcase down and right out to the platform. It just struck me like a thunderclap from the moment I arrived. Hey, I'm in a different place here. And the sorts of public values I'm talking about are compassion for others, love and respect for the elderly. That's me, by the way. Love of and care of children, public optimism about the future, Dr. Astrov, in 100 years' time it'll all be better, the love of motherland, a sense of a society that functions under an implicit and agreed social contract. More than a few Russians feel that the triumph of individualism in the West has come at a price they would not wish to emulate in their society. Now, Mr. Navalny would not think that, but most Russians, I think, would be of the view that do we really want Western individualism? And I think for most of them, the answer is, well, no, we don't. And who's to say they're wrong? My next heading is family and community. And there's an important point I want to make here, and that is the role of three-generation families and the role of extended families. You see how everything sort of hangs together? At least I hope I'm conveying how everything hangs together. In Russia, as in Spain, a deeply conservative Catholic country too, Russia Orthodox, Spain Catholic, I found familiarity and ease with three-generation extended families, often living together under the same roof. Maybe it's the product of past suffering and losses of so many husbands and fathers at the battlefront, in war and in civil war. Grandparents, uncles, and aunts were actually needed to help mothers, single mothers, widowed mothers, divorced mothers, take care of the children while they had to go out to work. So, grandparents, uncles, and aunts actually have a role. They're not just sitting in their little apartments by themselves thinking, when are my children going to telephone me? They are needed. They are there. And you can see this in the wonderful film starring Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer, The Russia House. You see how Katya, a single mother, sort of relies on her extended family to help her cope. And they all rely on each other, and it's a wonderful thing. So everybody's got a role to play. Everybody contributes to family welfare and security, even when they're no longer in paid employment. And that is a thing to celebrate. It's a wonderful thing. My next heading is Exile and Return. And this famous painting by Repin, We Weren't Expecting You, Mui Nizhdali, is so indicative of Russian history. He painted that in 1884, but the whole terrible Stalinist experience of the Gulag is really kind of wrapped up in that photo and painting. People coming back from the Gulag looked like that. And how terribly families suffered under Stalin. They really did suffer under Stalin, from all classes of society, not just from the Communist Party, not just from the intelligentsia, but everyone, peasants, and anybody who basically fell foul of neighbors and this terrible, suspicious and punitive system sent them to the Gulag. I talk about this a lot in my book. And there's a wonderful book by Stephen Cohen, The Victims Return, Survivors of the Gulag After Stalin, which I would recommend you seek out and try to buy. You can buy it from Amazon. I haven't read a better book on the whole Gulag experience than Stephen Cohen's The Victims Return. And it's very conflicted for Russian people, you see, because while all this terrible stuff was going on, very good things were happening too under Stalin. Education and science were spreading rapidly to sectors of the population that had never had the opportunity to experience those things, creating all these new classes who are written about in Vasily Grossman's book, Stalingrad and Life and Fate, and Everything Flows. A whole new society is coming into being at the same time as millions of people are being brutalized in the Gulag. So where does this leave Russians? I mean, Russians, when I was there, which was after Stalin, but not that long after Stalin, I was there in 1968 and he died in 53. So I was there 15 years after he died. People were still very traumatized. They were intensely suspicious of each other. People wouldn't talk to each other at concerts unless they were talking to people they really knew. There was not that easy socialization. People were just kind of victims of trauma. And the torturers were as much victims as the tortured, because the torturers were asking, did we do the wrong thing? We did as we were told. We thought we were supporting the state. We followed orders. Were we wrong? So there's this great agony going right through society. Khrushchev tried to lance the boil. He started to lance the boil, but he actually had advisors who were in the Gulag with him. Who were in the Gulag and came back, and they became senior advisors to Khrushchev. Stephen Cohen's story, I never knew this. And he said to them, well, you know, how are we going to heal these wounds? And he tried Khrushchev before his time. But then Khrushchev was removed from power. Fortunately, he wasn't killed. He was removed from power and allowed to live out his days. And then there was a long conservative reaction. And of course, I was working in Russia during that conservative reaction in the Brezhnev years, which was a very conservative time. But then finally, under Gorbachev and under Yeltsin and under the present man, whose name I will not mention because I promise not to mention any contemporary politics today, there has been this rediscovery of Russia's modern history, this very painful history. And the Gulag History Museum in Moscow, which I visited, is a wonderful museum. It was opened in 2004 and moved to a magnificent new building in the suburbs in 2015. And the Moscow Monument to the Victims of Political Repression, which is what we're talking about, was only unveiled in 2017. And I saw that too. So I'm on my last three pages, folks. Russian people come out of this 68 years after Stalin's death and 30 years after the end of the Soviet communist state. I would say amazingly well. Their resilience draws on the spiritual strength of a tradition of coping with autocratic rule and unjust disgrace, going right back to the Tsarist era. And some of you may have seen in the Russian Film Festival last year the marvelous film The Union of Salvation, a reconstruction of the Decabristi revolt, the Decembrist revolt. Wonderful film. And families right back then had to deal with terrible tragedies of exile and public shaming from powerful aristocratic families, and whole new Russian outposts of Russian culture were created in places like Irkutsk, of people who were literally never allowed to return. They were sent out there and told, never return. This guy managed to return, many didn't. Pushkin narrowly escaped being sent to Siberia because he'd associated with many of the ringleaders of the Dekabristi. Dostoevsky was literally on the point of being executed, and then he was reprieved along with the Tsarist reprieve came down at the last minute. Pasternak experienced both state favor and state repression. His lover, Olga Rivinskaya, was cruelly imprisoned twice, and she lost a baby, Pasternak's baby, in her first imprisonment. So all of that lived cruelty is expressed in Dr. Zhivago, and Lara is actually Olga. At the end of the book, Zhivago's old friends, Misha Gordon, a Jew, and Nikki Durov, who are both officers in the Red Army fighting at the front, and they've both been in the Gulag, and they're looking back philosophically on their lives. And both had been unjustly imprisoned for political crimes before the war and then released to fight. In a famous passage, they agree that the war came as a breath of fresh air, as an omen of deliverance, as a purifying storm. Everyone without exception, at home and at the front, all took a deep breath and flung themselves into the furnace of this deadly, liberating struggle with real rapture. Zhivago and Lara's daughter, Tanya, who has a terrible time in Siberia, the promised security that Komarovsky offers, finishes. And she has the most terrible traumatic experiences. And she finishes up a poorly educated laundry girl on the front. Zhivago's half-brother, a KGB major general, Yevgrav Zhivago, finds her by accident. And he promises that after the war, he'll look after her and give her a proper home and a proper upbringing. And Tanya symbolizes, in Pasternak's words, the moral flowering of this generation, her character tempered by misfortune, unspoiled and heroic. So Pasternak is saying, really, what we've all been through, the revolution, Stalinism, we've come through. The future looks brighter. And I'm sure that's right. I'm going to say some final words, if we can have the next slide, on war and remembrance. And this is very appropriate because Victory Day is next Sunday, the 9th of May. It's also the day of Besmertny Polk, the Immortal Regiment, which is the civilian parade of people with photos and medals of their family members who fought and very often perished in the Great Patriotic War. And this is a relatively new tradition. It's only been going for a few years. But I think it's become more important than the military parades in a way, because it's people paying homage to their forebears for the sacrifice that made the good life of modern Russians today possible. And they go out in their tens of thousands in the streets in real street parades. Not the silly ones you see that Navalny tries to organize, but these are real street parades, a real outflowing of love, of respect. And I want to march in one of those in Moscow or St. Petersburg before I die. I actually took part in a small ceremony at Glebe Park a couple of years ago, and it gave me a little bit of the feeling. We go back to Georgi Zhukov on his horse, and I promised I'd finish with a story. He sits proudly in the saddle of his stallion Kumir. Of course, Zhukov did not fight World War II on horseback. He was in a tank or in a staff car. But he was a good rider, and at the end of that terrible war, Stalin, who could not ride at all, instructed Zhukov to ride a white horse into Red Square to take the salute in the first victory parade on the 9th of May, 1945. And a search took place across Russia to find the horse. Kumir was chosen, a light gray riding horse of top Russian Arab bloodlines, 4 years old and in his prime, from the Tersky Russian Arab stud farm in the Northern Caucasus. Kumir was already an experienced military parade horse. Nothing spooked him at all. So Zhukov and Kumir practiced together for a month before the parade. They were determined to put on a good show for the nation. And thus it was that in Russia's most solemn military parade, at the end of this unbearable ordeal of the Great Patriotic War, a man and his horse rode out proudly together into Red Square to take the victorious Red Army salute. Мой подъем с конем по полю вдвоем. Мой подъем с конем по полю вдвоем. Together, my horse and I will ride out into the field. Thank you very much, everybody.